The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, case 70. Jijian asks about nature. The pointer. One who hears the scent-bearing elephant crossing the river has already gone with the flow. Even one who knows that birth is unborn is stayed by birth. If you go on talking about before concentration and after concentration, making bamboo shoots and making bamboo rope, you'll be marking the boat when the sword is long gone already. Kicking the wheel of potential into motion, how can you particularly travel on one road? Let's try to bring this up. The koan. Master Jinshan asked Master Zhushan, clearly knowing the unborn nature of life, why are we stayed by life? Zhushan said, bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo, but if you use them now for bamboo rope, can you make them? Zhushan said, I'm just this way. What is your meaning? Jinshan said, this is the monastery superintendent's quarters. That is the cook's quarters. Zhushan then bowed. Hongzhi's poem. Empty and at ease, without dependence, lofty and serene, untrammeled. Home and country peaceful. Those who arrive are rare. A little bit of power divides ranks and grades. The fluid, clear mind and body is beyond right and wrong. Right and wrong ended, standing alone on earth, there is no beaten track. Even one who knows that birth is unborn is stayed by birth. When the Buddha was enlightened, later, I suppose after the Buddha had died, there was a question as to whether, because he still had a human body, which is subject to everything that every human body is subject to, was his nirvana a complete freedom? Or was it a freedom with remainder, the remainder being the body? And so it's spoken of sometimes as nirvana and then paranirvana, when he was free of the physical body. This question that comes up a lot, that if we have Buddha nature, perfect, complete, without any flaw, already peaceful, it's already present, that everything is always in motion, always changing, nothing is fixed, or determined, then why are we held back by life? If that's the nature of every single person, why don't we just all live naturally out of that? One who hears the scent-bearing elephant crossing the river has already gone with the flow. I wasn't able to actually get any clarification on the scent-bearing elephant, other than that elephants have very strong sense of smell, which I don't think is what this is pointing to. So that's some cultural reference that I don't understand. But the point of the pointer that is pointing to the koan is, what about before enlightenment? What about after enlightenment? If one already knows that birth is unborn, then why would they be stayed by birth? Why would that still hold them back? And then the question that he asked, kicking the wheel of potential into motion. Enough of this conversation about before and after. Kick the wheel of potential into motion. Now, how can you particularly travel on the one road? How can you travel on this one road in this particular moment? The world is vast and wide. And the Dharma recognizes that there are a few things that we have some control over. control over, not in the sense of being controlling, but in the sense of direct influence, direct impact. Your thoughts, your mind, certain aspects of your life. But there is so much that we are just not in control of. Do not have direct influence on. We can have other kinds of influence. And that so much of what we cannot control can be the cause of so much heartache and so much misery. And so dukkha is kind of coming from the perspective of recognizing that, well, just extend that control to people, to situations. It's sort of the ultimate dominator model of the world. Don't like what you see, well, just change it till you like it, till it is what you like. To try and change others in the world to suit our desires, or we can deal with our desires, examine those, try and understand them. What are the healthy desires? What are the unhelpful desires? How do we diminish those that are just not actually working on our behalf? Not really. And what are the ones that are that we want to strengthen? And how do we be clear about that? Dogen said, the mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. There, he said it. Right? It was true in 1200. It's true in the time of the Buddha. It is still true. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change, which is kind of interesting given the fact that it is nothing but change. It is only change. So what he's really saying is the mind of a sentient being is difficult to change towards its ultimate nature, towards, as a practitioner, what we really want to be making our lives about, how we want to live this life, how we want to bring forth this mind. And he says, so, keep on changing the minds of sentient beings. From the moment that you offer one gift, one generosity, to the moment that you and all beings attain the way, the bodhisattva vow. Initiate this by giving. This is why it is the first of the six paramitas, the practices of the bodhisattva. Because everybody can give. Everybody has something they can give. And so this is how he says we begin working on changing the minds of sentient beings. And of course, the one who gives, their mind is also changing by virtue of that one action. And so internally we have challenging thoughts and emotions and memories and reactions and traumas and sensations. And outside we have people and governments and ideologies and systems and greed, anger, and delusion and profusion, inequality and oppression. And perhaps it's safe to say it's always been so. We might say it's likely to continue. So given that, where do we find peace? What is liberation, given that there is so much we cannot control? And that our vow is to alleviate that very suffering. And so Jinshan asks this question. They are Dharma brothers. Not sure of their dates, so I'm not sure how they're, whether there's a younger or an elder, it doesn't matter. But they're Dharma brothers of Master Dizhang. This is 10th century China. And so Jinshan asks this question of his Dharma brother, clearly knowing the unborn nature of life. Why are we stayed by life? Knowing the unborn, knowing that there is a self nature, your self nature, which has never been born and will never die. The Buddha spoke of it as the birthless and the deathless. It is not of characteristics in time and space and before and after. It is not an idea. And it is our basic nature. Clearly knowing this, so we might have a conceptual understanding of this, we might have realized this directly. Conceptually understanding, it makes sense why we would still be stayed by life, because that's just an idea. And all of the ideas that we've had much longer and have invested much more into, and in a certain sense probably still have much more faith in, are still often in charge. But what about when we've realized it directly? We now know directly that the self is empty of any inherent intrinsic substance. Why then are we stayed by life? Well, one easy way to respond to that is that even though we will still continue to be challenged and be stayed as long as the power of the self and its habits show up. I mean, what else is it that holds us back but that? There's a poem that I like very much by Master Dogen, "A Tiny Hut Deep in the Mountains, the Way Not Yet Perfectly Attained." Even on this highest peak of this splendid mountain, the dirt and dust of the world, I beg for the help of the Tathagata. I beg for the help of the Buddha. Even there, still held back. And this can, particularly in the early stage, until we really understand, can be very discouraging. You know, we can hear this in very dualistic view. I mean, how else will we tend to hear it? So if it's, we're still held back by life, then that means something isn't working. The Dharma doesn't work, realization doesn't really make a difference. So what's the point? But that's looking at it from a dualistic perspective. It's either all right or it's all wrong. It's fixed or it's still broken. There's a story of a master. It was Jinshan, who was a senior monk monastic under Dizhang, his teacher. And two monastics came and bowed to Dizhang, and Dizhang said, "Both wrong." And neither of them said anything. And then they went to help ask Master Zhushan about this. Like, what was that? And Zhushan said, "You yourselves are magnificent and outstanding, and yet you bow to someone else. Is that not wrong? Is that not putting a head on top of your own? Is that not, if you see the Buddha on the road, if you see the Buddha outside of yourself, kill the Buddha?" But Jinshan, hearing of this, didn't agree. And he said to Zhushan, "You yourself are deluded and ignorant. How can you help anyone?" Zhushan didn't like that. Says he got indignant, and he went back to Dizhang and asked for clarification. And Dizhang pointed to the hall and said, "The cook went down into the pantry." And Zhushan then, it says, realized his error. The cook went down into the pantry. So, is he magnificent and outstanding, or is he deluded and ignorant? He wanted to know. Dizhang said, "The cook went down into the pantry. Is that special or is that ordinary? Is that correct or incorrect? Is that a right or wrong answer?" Clearly knowing the unborn, why are we stayed by life? Zhushan says, "Bamboo shoots will eventually become bamboo. But if you use them now for bamboo rope, how will they serve their purpose? They're not ready yet." It's a very logical response. It makes sense. Right? We get that. If you're learning something new, you're in the early learning stages, you may not be ready yet to go out on the stage and perform a piece of music or to make a presentation or to do something that requires more skill. There's a story of, in the time of the Buddha, a young woman, Antisha, whose family was offering a meal to the Buddha and his Sangha. So there's a big gathering. And Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, said, "Is there anyone who knows the unborn nature of life who is held back by life?" And Antisha said, "There is. The one who clearly sees, yet whose strength is not yet sufficient, is held back by life." Same response. But the answer remains, if clearly seeing, then why should anyone be held back? What is strength not yet sufficient? Well, Zhushan was indignant at being told that he was still deluded? Did he notice that? When the sense of self is still sitting in the seat of the ruler, there is much to protect, much to defend. And I've said this many times, but the language that we use in Buddhism, because it gets used, we use it over and over again. There's a danger in that. In the beginning, when we first hear it, it's new and fresh, but it's difficult to understand. And as we hear it more and more, and maybe have understanding, develop understanding, it's quite easy to hear it less and less. We've heard this before. And so we sort of just tune it out. We stop listening. And to really reflect on what is the world of duality, what does that mean? How is it to be in the world and see and experience everything through the lens of opposites, of two, of this and that? If something is broken, then it's not fixed. When it's fixed, it's no longer broken. If something is working, then that means it's not working. So Zhushan said, you are magnificent and outstanding. And Jinshan said, you're deluded and ignorant. The teachings say that when we hold up right as an absolute, then look and see if you can find anything in right that is right. Does right exist independently within the word or the idea of right? Does wrong exist as its own thing, as its own entity, have its own essence in anything that you point to as wrong? Then a reasonable person might ask, well, if that's true, then why do we use this language? That question was asked of the Buddha, and he said they are convenient designations. We have this great power, this great gift of language, we should use it. But we should use it knowingly. In the collection of poems of the Theragata, the poems of the early Buddhist nuns, there's a poem by Dantika, who came to the Dharma as an adult. She was ordained by Mahapajapati. And she wrote this poem saying, having come out from where I spent the day on the mountain, I saw an elephant on the riverbank that had come out from the river it had plunged into. A man holding a goad told the elephant, hold up your foot. And the elephant put its foot forward, and the man climbed on. I saw in this how the untamed became tamed, how the animal was led by the human. I concentrated my mind, for I went into the forest for just this, to tame what was untamed, to sort of let go of all of those realms of existence that can rule us, can seem to overpower us, so that we can be led by the human, by Buddha nature, by our wisdom. Bamboo shoots before they're ready don't serve the purpose for bamboo rope. And Jinshan says, well, later on you'll be enlightened on your own. So if it's not about right and wrong, if it's not that the whole thing can be reduced down to opposites, then how is it? We can think of trying to resolve that by, well, we just blend them. You know, Dada Roshi used to say that the resolution or the liberation of light and dark is not gray, not something in between. It's not a matter of balance, although balance can be very good. To not live, to be free of right and wrong, can be very often and mistakenly taken to be morally apathetic, indifferent, which has never been a Buddhist teaching. That's just another duality. There's another greater reality that Dharma practice is particularly bringing us to. And what is so difficult about that is that we come into practice so faithful to our ideas and our concepts and our beliefs and all of the inner strategies and everything that has kind of gotten us here, right? It seems more or less to have been working. We don't even have to think about it. It just shows up. It's hard to deliberately let that go. It's hard to let it go, particularly when we don't have a sense, you know, it's like, I'll let go of this handhold on this precipitous path as soon as I have the next handhold, right? I'm all right with that. But to let go of this one when there is no handhold, that I'm not so sure about. And so Zhushan says, well, I'm just this way. What is your meaning? This is the way I see it. What is your understanding? And Jinshan said, this is the monastery superintendent's quarters. That's the cook's quarters. He doesn't get entangled in discussions of right and wrong. He doesn't offer explanations. Here, just this is it. But those are words, convenient designations. It's like they take us to the entrance into the woods, but they do not take us into the woods. Or they take us to the edge of the precipice, but they do not help us, they do not allow us or make us leap forward without a handhold. When we realize that things have no self-essence and that they never have, so we might think, well, how can I be doing this thing that I call my life? How can I be living, doing what I'm doing, making decisions, thinking, making plans, responding, if there isn't a self? You've been doing it all this time without a self, without an essence that exists by itself that is permanent and is you. So it's only the sense of self that we hold on to as a comfort that is necessary. But we've already proven that it's not. Seeing that it has no power of its own, is empty of inherent substance, then we can actually take care of what needs our attention. And what is no longer in the way is that sense of self, which will inevitably need to be defended, protected, built up, or torn down, depending on our inclinations, preserved, defined. We can take care of what needs to be taken care of, as we say, selflessly, without that idea that there is someone doing something to someone else. We call that in Buddhism compassion. That's the basic working definition of compassion. Dogen says the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? The whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? Now he's drawing upon all of these basic practice understandings that we have to practice and gain realization. We have to apply special effort. We have to clear ourselves of the dust, of all our entanglements. But he's saying the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could you even do that? It is never apart from this very place. What is the use of traveling around to practice? Why have a monastery? And then he says, and yet, if there is a hair's breadth deviation, where? It is like the gap between heaven and earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So when Jinshan said, this is the monastery superintendent quarters, that's the cook's quarters, can you find any like or dislike, right or wrong, magnificence or delusion here? not finding it. Now, who is held back by life? So then what happens in the moments when that has been seen through and we are being held back? In that moment, that which has been seen is not being actualized. Having tamed the untamed, having freed the Buddha from its entanglements, those entanglements still have energy, still have life. That's why the idea, the false idea that we can practice, apply of effort, have an experience that we call enlightenment, and be done, the whole idea of being done. If you're an artist, when are you done? If you're a school teacher, if you're a parent, when are you done? Talking to many parents over the years, it seems very clear, never. But not just done in the sense of there's still something to do, but in the sense of strengthening your strength, refining your skills. Think of why is that image of Avalokiteshvara with all of the hands, and in all of the hands there's an implement. What's that about? It's all of your skills. It's all of your good qualities. It's all that you have to bring forward in a moment. And so to develop a larger palette from which to draw upon to help. So that, as he says in the verse, Hongzhir says in the verse, we move more towards being empty and at ease without dependence. But the Buddha said all conditioned things arise in codependence, causes and conditions. Nothing appears on its own. Nothing is independent. And it's that that brings forth all of life. But then there's the dependence upon thoughts and emotions, beliefs and fears, the sense of self, which is a kind of false dependence, false in the sense of not so helpful. False in the sense of it's based on false, on notions and assumptions that when tested, when examined, can't actually be proven to be true. And so delusion is basically a state of being that is universal, that is drawing upon the legacy of all that has been passed down to us, and also just on the experience through our own senses, and that is based on some very fundamental assumptions that we can go our whole lives and never actually examine, that when we do examine them, we can't actually find a basis for those assumptions. That's what the Buddha came to in his enlightenment. When we see that the one who is angry, that the object of our anger, that the ideas justifying our anger, and the anger itself all have the same nature, are empty and at ease. Their basic nature is without dependence. They are not a result of something. Their basic nature is not a result of something. Anger, the person, the action, the consequence, all arises in dependence on something. Well, what if the basis of what that which it is dependent upon changes? Such that rather than anger coming forth, what comes forth is compassion. Rather than greed or stinginess coming forth, because those are the conditions which have been cultivated that make those experiences, those desires, those impulses come forward. What if the basis of those changes? And what comes forth is generosity, magnanimity. Indeed, Ongzhir says, the whole body is free from dust. Or Dogen says, who could believe in a means to brush it clean? Then there is both taming the untamed, that's what we practice, without any possibility of brushing it clean. You are not improving yourself in a fundamental way. You are not fixing in any way something that is fundamentally broken. And that's very important for us to really reflect on and hear over and over and take in and try and really integrate into how we're sitting. Because how we understand that will definitely show up in how we sit, in what we are actually doing on this meditation cushion, as well as off. And so if we're trying to fix what is broken, if we're trying to brush clean something that is impure, then we will use our mind and in a sense misuse our zazen in such a way to try and make that work. And what we're doing in a sense is nothing different than before. And so we'll kind of get the same results. That's why the Dogen and so many teachers, virtually every teacher, certainly in the Mahayana, emphasizes that basic point. The Dogen, that from the beginning, there is no gap. There is no imperfection. But Dogen goes on to say, consider, though, the Buddha, who, although he was wise at birth, and the traces of his 6 years of upright sitting can still be seen. We're still seeing the manifestation, the effects of the Buddha's enlightenment. And as for Bodhidharma, although he received the mind seal, his 9 years of facing a wall is celebrated still. If these ancient sages were this way, why did they keep practicing? If they were so clear, so deeply enlightened, why did they keep sitting? The Buddha kept sitting throughout his whole life. Why? And Dogen says, that being so, how can we today dispense with wholehearted practice? So I think of a great violinist or a painter or a woodworker, a school teacher, who continues to refine and sharpen. Like a violinist, the instrument is perfect. I actually believe that the violin is the perfect instrument. It's just my opinion. So that's not what's being refined. The instrument's not being refined. The instrument's not being perfected. It's the violinist. To bring forth the joy that the potential that that instrument has to bring. And so he says, put aside the intellectual practice of investigating words, chasing after phrases, and take the backward step. Right? So in our normal lives, we're constantly moving out, moving out, moving out. And so much of what we experience in the world is calling us out, calling us out, calling us out. And so Dogen is saying, take the backward step. Turn the light around and shine it inward. Then body and mind of themselves will begin to drop away and your original face, your basic nature, will begin to manifest. If you want to realize this, get to work on this. And yet know that all the while, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. It cannot be brushed clean. It cannot be made perfect. And so in the poem he says, however, a little bit of power divides ranks and grades. Yes, this we know. The footnote to that says, forcibly creating subdivisions. This is like the leitmotif. In music, the leitmotif is the theme that keeps showing up, it keeps showing up, it keeps showing up, it keeps showing up. The context, the time, the place, the speed, the volume, all of that can change. But this one theme keeps showing up over and over again. Power, ranks, grades, divisions, forcibly creating boundaries, sides. And so we encounter within ourselves, we encounter within others, people, situations, dogmas, fears, hatreds, ideologies, inequalities. And so today, celebrating Juneteenth, I was reading a piece by a professor, Harvard professor. You know, there's that thing about people who go to Harvard always having to get into the conversation that they went to Harvard. But I guess even when you refer to somebody, you have to do that for them. So she's a Harvard professor. And she was talking about the birth of this, that June 19th in 1865, a U.S. general went to Galveston, Texas, and announced the end of slavery in Texas. But that Lee had surrendered the Southern Army 2 months before. But the fighting had gone on. And that the army in Texas, even when they knew that the war had ended and slavery was no more, they continued to fight until June. And I just thought of that as that fixation, that obsession, that attachment to not stop, to keep going, even though it is so clearly over. That's why the teachings talk about the sort of natural and necessary evolution, transition from being infatuated and tempted and sort of in love with samsara to growing weary of it. It's just not that tempting anymore. I was listening to an interview with the 50th anniversary of the Watergate event. There have been all these interviews and conversations with Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, who opened that whole door up. And I was listening to an interview with them and Colbert, and he said, after going through the whole thing and drawing a lot of analogies and parallels between then and now, with the January 6th hearings and all that preceded them, and Colbert said at the end of the interview, is there still hope for us as long as the truth is still pursued, as long as this truth is still being brought out? And both Woodward and Bernstein just sat there. And I thought, yeah, it's hard to say. And then one of them said, if the people of this country are open-minded to the truth, that it's not enough just to bring the truth out. There are truth tellers everywhere. There have been truth tellers forever. In every religious tradition, there are truth tellers. That's not enough. We have to be open-minded to the truth. What does it mean to be open-minded? What happens if you think about yourself, if I think about myself in a moment of not being open-minded to something, and then that shifting, what is actually happening in that kind of extraordinary event, human event, where something that was closed begins to open, where a door that is letting in no light, suddenly light begins to come in, where something that had no possibility becomes possibility, where something that we would not consider, we begin to consider. Something we could not imagine, we begin to imagine. I mean, think about that. Maybe that's like one of the most quintessential, I don't know about whether it's quintessentially human, but it's pretty damn important and revolutionary and propitious in terms of it being making something possible. If the people of the country are open-minded to the truth, but you know, maybe that's not even enough. We can be aware, we can be open-minded to our own mind, to our own attachments and habits, to our karmic afflictions. We can be very aware of them and not practice them. Continue to hold on. Go no further. And so that's why practice is challenging, because it's not just one thing that's necessary. And yet each thing is necessary for the next thing which is necessary to occur. And yet all of those exist naturally within us. All of those we have complete access to. And yet it's the environment, the conditions inside and outside that allows, I think, that sort of development of that permeability, that possibility. When a little bit of power has divided ranks and grades, so that we can begin to see, as Hongzhi says, the fluid, clear mind and body that is beyond right and wrong. There is more than just that. And then, right and wrong ended, or maybe right and wrong now freed from right and wrong. Standing alone on earth, there is no beaten track. One master wrote a poem, "Pity that my mind is clear, but my power is not yet sufficient. Time after time, seeds produced manifest patterns. Like a person gone crazy from wine, no sooner sworn off drink than finding some more fine liquor." But do you take any comfort? I do. In hearing those words that go back all the way, those moments of affirmation, of recognition of what I experience, of what we experience, that it doesn't mean we are doing something wrong in those moments where time after time seeds produce manifest patterns. That's the nature of our consciousness. That's the nature of karma. That's the nature of our attachments. That's why we have to keep coming back to this seat. We have to keep coming back to this training hall. We have to keep practicing. Standing alone on earth, there is no beaten track. Home and country, peaceful. That's our nature. Buddha means peace. No conflict. And so when we see so much conflict, so much lack of peace, what we're seeing is the depth and the strength and the extent of our inner turmoil. That's why I think of our time as in our country as like being deep and within us illness of the self, of spiritual, a kind of sickness, which is something that Buddhism has described itself in the Dharma for 2,500 years, a spiritual sickness, which is the root of all sicknesses. And so that we can face the dogmas and beliefs and madness and without getting caught as though they exist by themselves and have the power to catch me, to control my mind, to make me feel something, to paralyze me, to overwhelm me. But we have to learn how to face all of those experiences. And so I think of one aspect of that standing alone is the practitioner who, you know, it's kind of like a freelancer. If you're going to be a freelancer, you're holding the whole thing, right? Like you don't go to the office, somebody else has done all the work for you. And then you get to go home and you don't have any more responsibilities. All the responsibility is yours. I think of spiritual practitioners as being kind of like that. Right? No one else is actually going to do this. And in that, there's a kind of standing alone. There's a kind of going alone. You know, particularly if we don't have a lot of noble friends. Or we look in the world and sometimes feel alone in being concerned and wanting to free ourselves of the delusions. And there is no beaten track means, even though so many have come before you, not this one, not this one. And so every step is brand new. So I hope you like journeys without predictions, without knowing exactly where you're going or how it's going to end up. In the end of the poem, the footnote brings forth the image of the halcyon. Halcyon has no reservations. Halcyon is a bird. It's in the kingfisher family. But in ancient legends, it was able to rest at sea and calm the waters. It had that much power. And not just calm the waters, but it could charm the wind. So, are you up to that? I think so.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.